And welcome back to another Liberty Librarian. This is your host, Heather Biederman, and it is a wild and wacky Monday here in Minnesota, where the weather is all of a sudden beautiful again, and yet, within the week, they predict that there might be snow, so you never know how it is here. It's just that weird. And this last week has been kind of odd. You know, I went and saw a couple concerts, and I think that I've been to some venues where it was super well done, and some where you wait outside for an hour and a half. And, you know, when you have a good experience with anything in your life, you remember it and promptly forget it. But then when you have a really bad experience, isn't the truth that it just comes back to you every time that you think about it. So I'm going to try, as a wise grown-up person, supposedly, to think about the good stuff and remember that and not focus on the bad, because it's so easy to get in that twisted warp of things. And you'd think I would be getting better at it. This actual week is my birthday week. Whoa, happy birthday to me. So I'm going to try to do some fun stuff, and we'll see, you know. It's the way it is it seems like, you know, the older you get, birthdays kind of don't feel as exciting, but you still want to have fun and celebrate. So I just think I'm going to put an ad on real quick, and then I will be right back. I just want to make sure we do that, since last time I wasn't able to.
Please learn more about Freedomizer Radio by going to freedomizerradio.com, and also Facebook us right at freedomizerradio.com. Catch you there.
Come join us as we peel away the layers of the unseen, unknown, and uncharted. And we hope you tune in late night, 9 p.m. Pacific time, to get ready to find a clarity after dark.
Okay, so I've done my due diligence, did some ads, right? So, yeah. So, Old Lady Heather is having her birthday. What else? I've had like a lot of odd things happen in my life. I have changed what I wanted to be when I grow up. I've accomplished great things. I got published. You know, what's next? You know, what do you think? What is your dream? You know, birthdays are one of those times, sort of like that, New Year's Eve, don't you think? Like, reevaluate the past year, the past in general, and you think, am I going the way I want it to go? And it is kind of, it's hard. I'm getting looked at by my husband. He's just giving me crazy eye. But, you know, again, stop it. I'm live, damn it. So, you know, what do you want to do? And Allison Sabo was talking on her YouTube video today, and I watched it on my lunch break, and she was talking about doing NaNoWriMo, because it's writing month, right? So she was talking about really cool tools that you can use, and I'm going to post a link to it on my Liberty Librarian page, because I think it was really helpful. And she talks about how on the NaNoWriMo page that there are deep discounts for some of the writing tools there. And she talked a little bit about other tools that she uses for it. I know she uses another grammar one than I do, but Grammarly has worked really well for me. And I use a lot of free tools because I'm cheap. And as a librarian, I don't make tons of money, but you know, you want to make sure that you keep working on the things that you love. So if your dream is to get published, or if your dream is to start a podcast, or if your dream is to climb a mountain or run a marathon, there are tools and techniques that you can use to make everything happen. But the one thing I know with my birthday coming up is that you start thinking out, how do I make these things happen? I'm getting older. I don't want to miss out. I want to make sure that all of these things keep happening. And I have had people kind of complain at me in a weird way where they go, oh, well, you're just lucky, Heather. You know, like, I don't remember ever being lucky. I'm just going to say, I feel lucky because I'm healthy and I try really hard at being happy. And sometimes it's not easy, but I always think about, you know, what is the goal? What is, you know, and you think about small goals, because, you know, I want to be a millionaire. I remember I dated a guy that was his ultimate goal. I'm like, how are you going to make that happen? Well, I guess I'm going to buy a lottery ticket. And he would never buy lottery tickets. You know, it's like, if that was your only strategy and you're not even doing that, then you're failing at it. And, you know, if it's actually your dream, why not try to make it happen? If you don't get there, you at least tried. And I feel like some people are just so afraid that they might fail that they never start. So, I can see that being something that's detrimental and terrifying, but you can't let it hold you back. I really believe that, you know, you're put on this earth to do some things that are amazing. And I think you're an incredible person. Obviously, you're interested in some of the same stuff I am, so we have a lot in common, right? You probably want to do some of the stuff I want to do. So how do we help each other? How do we make that happen? And like, one of the things I think is, and I think it really works, is like the Agorist Writers Workshop idea, where you get a group of people together who have common interests, common goal, and you help each other. You work together and you find a way to make things happen. Like, make an anthology. You get people together who've never written. Like, how do you write? Let's help each other. You know, a lot of us have been out of school for a long time, so it's not just like jumping on a bicycle again. You need to, you know, retrain your brain. How do you do the things that are important? And if people tell me, well, I don't know if I have a story in me, like a, you know, Pulitzer Prize winning story. I'm like, who cares? You have a story. You're you. You're unique. You're special. And you have something to say. What is it that you need to put out in the world? And maybe it's something that's not like writing or art, but maybe it's, I want to make the perfect engine. I want it to run amazing. I want to make something out of this. I want to have a super organized house that runs like a, you know, a watch, you know, everything is perfect in it. And, you know, like, what makes you happy? Work towards that, you know? And for me, it's really hard because I procrastinate. I'm going to say that out loud. I procrastinate. And I often will have something I'm really excited about, and I will wait to the last minute to do it all. And it's hard, because I know I see myself doing it and I know I'm doing it, but up until the point where I am just terrified into this has to happen now or it's never going to happen. Part of my brain, I feel like it almost shuts off, you know, like the creativity is like, nah, you don't need to do this yet. Nah. But I just wish I would be better at constantly doing something every day. And I think maybe that's the thing I can work towards. You know, even with this show, a lot of it is throughout the week, I think about things I'd like to have. But a lot of times I will wait on the news to the last minute. And sometimes it doesn't matter. Other times it makes me so anxious. The anxiety will eat you up. So I think for mental health wise, I think that planning ahead and knowing what you're going to work on and how long you're going to work on it could be a great asset to your whole well-being. So why not do a little bit every day? I read this weird article on Facebook, and at first I thought they're going to say what do all these writers have in common? And at first I thought, when I started reading it, it was going to be like they all woke up at 5 or 6 in the morning and worked on writing. And it kind of sounded like that. But what it really was is that all of them drank coffee. And I think it was just kind of a funny one-off that you need to be awake and alert. But I read into it that it was sort of rituals. You know, what do you do that's a ritual that makes you feel like you're ready to work? Do you need to have a big cup of coffee in front of you? Do you need to, like, go smoke a cigarette and get out there? Do you need to go exercise and then you're ready? Or do you need to do it before you do any of that? Some people have, like, lots of kids and family, and they like to get up really early so that way the house is quiet. They get at least a good half hour to an hour of writing time, and then they get into their day. Some of them wait until everybody goes to bed, and they do it at night. Some of them wait till everybody goes to school and they work at home. So they do it during the day. Like it's a job that they, you know, you check in and you check out. So I think like anything can be that. And people have told me there's different types of writing styles, like the seat of your pants or the plotter, you know, whatever you want to call it. There's so many different methods out there. But what works for you? And if the seat of the pants is what you think you are and it never works for you, you never write, maybe try one of the other ways. And this can be something that fits into other things besides writing. So if you have your agenda for running a marathon and you think you're going to work out after work every day, but when you get done with work, you're just too exhausted, then that's not working for you. Think about how you can make this happen and how it actually will work with your personality. Some people need, I like it to call it the oppressor. They need a friend or somebody who maybe they pay money, like somebody at the gym that will like keep on your butt so you keep working out. And you may have stuff like that at work where you're just like, I need to make sure there's a period of time where nobody bugs me and I can totally focus on work. So you put a sign on your door and go, come back at 2. And that gives yourself like an hour to get something done that you really need to get done. Because some people can't say no to social interaction. I get it. I am very much the same way. Somebody stops by my office and they want to talk, I will talk. But I also know that there's times I just got to shut the door and get the stuff done. So I hope that you think about that. And I think it's just because it's probably like my birthday and I think about, you know, what do I want to do? So saying this, just, you know, sometimes you just make bold proclamations, right? And you go, this November is NaNoWriMo, right? And so I'm going to start plotting out what I want to write and I'm going to try to write every day. And that might get hard because, you know, I got a radio show, I got work. We have things that are coming up. I have like, you know, all these little mini micro goals and they stack up. And then I want to do more reading and there's, I'm looking at maybe writing some intellectual freedom articles and how am I going to do it all? I don't know. We'll see. I'm very bad at procrastinating and I'd really like to get out of that loop. So if I find things that really work for me, I'll share it with you guys because I really want all of us to succeed. Because maybe if I help you, you go, hey, that Heather knows some stuff. I should recommend something. And I love helping people. I want everybody to succeed. I think that was one of my main reasons for going into being in libraries anyway, was to get to know people and find out what they're passionate about and try to push them in the right direction of getting their own success. It makes me happy. And it's taken me this long to figure out there's some stuff that I'm good at and that maybe I can help you. So anyway, on that note, I think I'm going to take one little break and then I am going to go into intellectual freedom news. And then after that, I have a little talk about rewriting history. It was came from, I'm looking at writing a censorship article, and free speech, and how our world is really keen on rewriting history so we forget the bad. that it didn't happen. Because when we are reminded of bad things by a name or by a place being called something, it freaks us out instead of having conversations. So I will be talking about that later. I have a few interesting things for that. So I'm going to do a real quickie little ad, and then we're going to come back and do our news. So see you in a bit.
Solutions to Delusions. How do you do this? Well, join me every Friday night on the Delusion Solution Radio Show from 6 to 9 p.m. Central Standard Time and 9 to 12 midnight Eastern Time right here on the Freedomizer Network, where we will be discussing and discerning the times by making sense of current events and bringing to light much-needed topics. Our call-in number is 347-324-3704 to listen in. Watching with your ears and listen with your eyes. I'm your host, Tara Dawn, and I'll see you there.
Learn more about Freedomizer Radio by going to freedomizerradio.com and also Facebook us right at freedomizerradio.com. Catch you there.
This is Heather. You're back to Liberty Librarian. I don't know what the deal is with those ads. It might have been just on my end, but it sounded really weird, so I'm going to listen to it in the playback and see what's going on with our ads, because it was all like, blah, 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 blah. So I don't know if you heard that too, but weird. So we had some intellectual freedom news, just a little bit, and a little commentary to go with it, just like normal. And like always, I like to plug that I get a lot of my news, the American Library Association Intellectual Freedom news page, and they have great news, and I'll try to post a link to their main page there on our Liberty Librarian Facebook page. But they run all across the, you know, everything like international news, censorship, you know, freedom of speech, things that are going on in the news. So I'm gonna pause for a second because my phone just started to ring and it's annoying. So I will just put one more ad on.
Imagine standing barefoot on cushy grass while you use a professional-grade knife to deftly chop fresh vegetables on your organic bamboo cutting board. The team at MyZestiness.com wants to help your family enjoy home cooking like this more often. They do this by offering fun and functional tools that make your time in the kitchen more efficient and enjoyable. MyZestiness.com offers the finest and most interesting kitchen goods and accessories, all backed by their world-class customer service team. Check out their ever-expanding inventory today. Visit MyZestiness.com. That's zesty like spicy, nest like home, MyZestiness.com.
I think I'm being stalked by CVS. Do you ever get that feeling? They keep like calling and calling, and it's always a robot caller, and you just go, why are you, why? And then when you go to CVS, you get those receipts that are like a mile long, and there's no way that is like makes any sense at all to use that much paper. But, you know, my insurance tells me I have to go buy things at CVS now. And it bothers me that it used to be you go just to your local pharmacy and your insurance would have no right at all to tell you where to go. It was all the same price. You could go anywhere. But now insurance companies make deals, huge deals with companies like CVS and Walgreens and wherever. And they specifically have a deal where you could pay the cheap price if you go to, like, let's say CVS in my case, or you could pay twice as much if you go anywhere else. Now that's crap. And I mean that, that is total crap. It shouldn't be like that. And I mean, drugs are already getting to be astronomical for everyday people to be able to, like, get the medication they need to just function normally. And I'm not even talking about people with like illnesses that are incurable, that their quality of life depends on the drugs that they have. There are people that are not getting the drugs that they need because they're priced out of it, and so they are suffering. So something to think about. I wasn't even going to go here with it, but dang you, CVS, for stalking me. So that has been on my mind, too, is the fact that this is not a fair system, and people are really being hurt by it. And, you know, like, I'm doing okay in life. I can afford my normal medications and whatnot, but I just can't imagine somebody finding out that their $20 pills a month go from $20 to $3,000 or more. How do you even deal with that? So I hope that somehow some of this starts to change. And I worry about the every man, every person out there that has to deal with this. So on that note, we're going to go into the news, because obviously Crabby Heather is crabby about all the things in the world. And I want to make it so I help you. And so I found a couple things that I think are helpful that will make Big Brother watch you a little bit less. So the first one I want to talk about is from Wired Magazine, and it's by Lily Hay Newman on October 2nd. And it's How Incognito Google Maps Protects You and How It Doesn't. So there's a new incognito mode in Google Maps won't make you as invisible as it might sound. So we've all talked before about how Google has an incognito mode that makes you feel like your browser history isn't going to be like obvious. Like if you share a computer, you're watching looking at dirty movies on the internet. You think your spouse won't be able to figure it out because you've been in incognito mode, so it won't show up in the history. Well, it sort of works that way, except that you're still using the internet, and every moment that you're on Google or you're using a browser that's by a major company, they are data mining you no matter what. How much they're data mining you depends on a lot of things, but a lot of it gets sent to Facebook. And if you think that they don't know what you're doing, you're kidding yourself. So I saw that Google had introduced a bunch of privacy improvements. They call it a raft. And among them was a new incognito mode for Maps, which prevents Google from saving certain types of data and removes personalization touches from the Maps app. Just don't assume that it makes your movements untraceable. So it will roll out for Android this month. And it said in a blog today, it builds on the incognito mode from the Chrome browser, which was first launched in 2008. So it's been around for a while. For the YouTube app, where it appeared earlier this year. But with those predecessors, it's important to understand not just the benefits, but the limits of incognito. So like we said, enabling the new feature stops data generated by that specific device from showing up in your Google location history. So if you're sharing your location with someone through Google Maps, it'll pause updates about that device's location when active. And Maps incognito mode also stops app-related notifications and app personalization, but it doesn't offer a protective blanket across all your devices. So when you turn it on in Maps incognito mode, you get a message that'll warn you, turning on incognito mode in Maps does not affect how your activity is used or saved by internet providers or other apps, voice search, and other Google services. So what does this mean? This means that Maps incognito mode isn't doing anything to mask or anonymize your web traffic to the outside world. is simply minimizing the record maps browsing in your own Google account and offering a way to pause location sharing with other maps users from that device. So it's mostly for yourself and people who use your accounts and people who you're sharing with. And usually when you're sharing with someone, you know that they have seen your maps in the past. So Chrome's incognito mode, which is similar, doesn't do anything to keep websites, employers, or internet service providers from seeing your browsing traffic because you're still using the internet. And how that ISP works is, you know, it shows that somebody from your computer went somewhere. So there's ways that you can make that a little more anonymized, but using Google incognito mode isn't enough to do it. So they wanted to give people more choice and control when it comes to how they manage their data on Google Maps. And they know there are certain times when you may not want activity tied to you. For example, you may say you want to share a device with your significant other. You probably don't want them to know that you recently searched for engagement ring stores nearby. So think of Google incognito mode then as a less sophisticated privacy tool and more of a pause button on a TV remote. Just as you use it occasionally when you're going to the bathroom or get a beer from the fridge. You want to anonymize your browsing and disrupt your internet service provider's insight. If you want to do that, the best way to do it would be to use a VPN or Tor, T-O-R. So those are a better option if you want to kind of, I don't know, not cover up, but give yourself some privacy to anonymize yourself. So a little bit more about the incognito mode maps. You'll use it. You simply tap your account photo in the upper right corner of your screen next to search bar and tap turn on incognito mode. You can also sign out of Google Maps, which accomplishes a lot of the same things and can be done without logging out of your Google account entirely on Android and iOS. But when you do that, the app will still record and show things like recent searches, which it won't when incognito mode is on. And when you're not signed in, you can't do things like share your location with other users. So if you want to use those types of features, incognito mode offers you a way to use them with pauses. So it's a new feature. And their privacy policy from Google says, when you're not signed into Google account, the company still collects and stores information about your browsing and behavior and services. But it ties that data to a unique identifier rather than a full account. Google says that data from incognito map sessions are stored in a unique identifier assigned to that incognito session. The ID is not tied to the user account and is reset with every new session. So it's designed to be used as needed, as opposed to being always on. So while you can still navigate, get directions, and search for places, if you're in an incognito mode, you lose all the personalized maps features, such as the ability to see restaurant recommendations or information tailored to your commute, which some people aren't going to care about. But Google announced other privacy-related gestures on Wednesday as well. So YouTube will now be offering a setting to auto-delete your video browsing history every 3 months or 18 months, which I'm going to talk about in a little bit. And they're also adding a password checkup, formerly an extension to Chrome's built-in password manager. So this tool combs stolen credentials from data breaches to flag any of your passwords that have been compromised. That's nice. So Google's trying because they've been called out. They want to improve the voice-related privacy within Assistant. So now you'll be able to say, hey, Google, delete the last thing I said. Or, hey, Google, delete everything I said last week without having to navigate through menus and settings in a browser. So Amazon is also adding similar data deletion to Alexa in May. So you'll be able to ask Google Assistant, hey, Google, how do you keep my data safe if you want to hear the whole spiel? So they're making incremental privacy tweaks, and they do add up over time. And this new slate of additions lends transparency and control to a number of important user data spigots. But for issues like location tracking and smart assistant interaction, the privacy stakes are too high for any one solution or several small ones to magically solve everything. So think about that. Make sure that you take a look when you, when they get some of these features turned on to see if it's something that's going to work for you. but realize that it's not going to fix everything. If you really need that, make sure you start looking for a VPN. I highly recommend. My favorite one right now is Windscribe, but there's a lot of them. And Tor is great. It's great. It works well. But, you know, everything can be hacked. Everything can have reasons where they can still get around it. So the best way to not have any privacy issues or any issues where your data can be compromised is, unfortunately, to not use the internet at all. And I've already resigned myself to that it's not going to happen. But I try to do precautions to make sure that everything is as safe as it can be. So I hope that you do the same. So I just mentioned a little bit more about Google data, and I found a separate article that talked about that in the New York Times. It was on the third. So on the third, there's a tech fix section on how to set your Google data to self-destruct, which I think is beautiful. I love that idea. So Google's now given us an option to set search and location data to automatically disappear after a certain time. And we should all use it, right?
Right.
And like, let's say you want to get rid of some of these things in, you know, your Google data histories. So people, they go through phases. And I think in the article they talk about, you might have once been addicted to Beyonce, but now you're into Lizzo, and you want to just erase that from your history. You don't want it to. The reason you might want to erase it is because you may be getting like recommendations for websites, and like on Amazon, you might be getting things that say, oh, you like Beyonce. It's your favorite artist. Here's everything about Beyonce. And you're like, I hate her now. Blah. So you can get rid of things. You can get rid of your history. Google keeps a record of our internet searches by default. And so the company hoards all your data. And that's how it makes money. So a lot of people forget to clear out your cache, clear out your histories, your browser histories. It's a lot going on in your life. Usually that's one of the last things you think of. So they built a tool in, some of these new privacy tools by Google. They have options to delete data related to your Google searches and requests made with its virtual assistant and your location history. So on this last Wednesday, Google followed up by expanding the auto-delete ability to YouTube. So in coming weeks, it will begin rolling in private mode, so you can navigate to a destination with Google Map apps. And if you want to keep it secret, like let's say you don't want people to know you're going to your therapist, you can wipe it off. So it's a great user experience. Part of that experience is, how does the user feel about the control they have? So how do you use it? So this person, Brian Chen, from the New York Times, tested the auto-delete in your search history. There's a web tool called My Activity, and the URL for it is myactivity.google.com. So you go to that site. Once you get into the tool, you go and click on Activity Controls. You'll see an option called Web and App Activity. You click Manage Activity, and then the button under the calendar icon. Here you can see set your activity history and several Google products to automatically erase itself after 3 months or after 18 months, whatever works for you. This data includes searches made on Google.com, voice requests made with Google Assistant, destinations that you looked up on Maps, and searches in Google's Play App Store. So which duration should you go for, they say? It depends on how much you care about getting personalized recommendations. So if you've been doing lots of Google searches on movies and celebrities, Google News will keep recommending news articles for you to read on those topics. So if you're really about a certain celebrity and you like go, I look for everything about Bill Hader and I want to know all of it, and let's say that's something that keeps going on for years and years, then fine, leave it, you know. But like, let's say you get interested in a lot of things and over time it changes really quickly. You know, maybe 3 months is your what you should set it to. But they say 18 months is probably a good option for most people. But if you like it to change all the time, set it to 3 months. Then it's wiping out the stuff that, like, you know, you go, that's so 4 months ago. I don't even care about that anymore. It, you know, making it wipe out, make it so you're only getting things about your current interests. So it's something to think about. But if you're the type who doesn't care to get personalized recommendations, then you can just disable the search history from being retained. You know, like, just get it, like, wiped off all the time. So then you're just getting stuff that comes out of the general purpose. You know, it's not being customized to you. Because, like, who cares? Some of it you don't care. And it is, I do think that I found some really cool stuff just because it knows, but it also terrifies me a little bit. So they have a way to walk through it too, how long to keep your YouTube history. But these controls give you the ability to auto-delete your YouTube history and all the things that you've watched. So in your My Activity tool, you click on Activity Controls and you look for a button in YouTube history. So you click on Manage History and you'll see a similar calendar icon, which lets you set YouTube history and delete after 3 months or 18 months. So you get the picture for each of these areas. You really customize it for what you're looking at. And then there's also that private mode that we talked about in Google Maps. And you could set that as well. And there's, you could turn on the incognito mode. And we had talked a little bit about what it did. But to turn it on, when you open up Google Maps app, you tap on the account icon in the upper right corner. Then you click turn on incognito mode. So, you know, it gives you a little extra level of privacy. And they also have an auto delete option for location history. So you, once again, you go into My Activity tool, click Activity Controls, scroll to Location History, and then click Manage Activity. So on the next page, you'll find an icon shaped like a nut, which I gotta go look at now that I think it looks like a nut. Like Mr. Peanut Nut or just a nut. And then click automatically delete location history. And you could set data to self-purge after 3 months or 18 months. So those are your options, 3 months or 18 months in general. And for those who don't want Google to create a record of the location history at all, there's also a switch for that. So also on your My Activities page, click Activity Controls, scroll to Location History, and turn the switch to the off position so it won't record any of your stuff. So not recording any of your stuff is probably the most private option out of all of these. But a lot of you do like some of the features that come with a little bit of the data tracking. It does simplify your life in some ways. It also means that they're making money off of you and your privacy is compromised. So maybe turning it off might be the best option. And they say to just do it. And by offering privacy tools, Google is a step ahead of Facebook and Twitter, which don't provide ways to easily delete large batches of dated posts. So there's no one-size-fits-all for people, you know, so obviously you might want to take a look at it. This author set up their search history to auto-delete, and they don't hardly ever use Google Assistant, and they don't use Google News. So they don't benefit from personalized recommendations. But if you use, but this, they also said they're often checking Google Maps, and it's useful to have a recent history and to have those searches to revisit the destinations. And I know I've done that too, where I'm like, where do they live again? And I look and go, oh yeah, that's easy. But you might not want it, and you might want it to automatically delete after a certain amount of time. And they totally said the YouTube history to self-destruct. And the author says they often watch videos about cooking different types of food. And sometimes they like it when they get new recipes based on searches. So they did 3 months. For myself, I'd probably do a little longer. But I think that an easy way to keep getting things that you really like is to subscribe to the ones that you like anyway. So that's probably your best bet. Or to save some of the videos that you've liked in the past so you can easily find that same site again. And then they set their auto location history to auto delete because it just gives you that sense that it's not all hanging out there. Your searches, your features aren't holding on to every little bit of data, And, you know, after a while, there's no need to keep it all. And it gives you a little bit more privacy. So I really think that's something to think about. So Google is really bringing up their game. And we just hope that Facebook and Twitter and Instagram and all of those, the giants and Amazon, keep following suit, because it's pretty horrible the way they've taken advantage of us. So I would like to see the changes, big changes. Okay, I'm going to switch gears. Switching gears. Click, click. Any of you watch Saturday Night Live? I do a little bit. I used to watch a lot more in the last couple years, not as much. I have Hulu, so sometimes I'll watch like clips or little sections of the show, or if there's a celebrity guest I'm interested in or a musician on the show, I'll watch for that. Or, you know, sometimes people pass stuff around they think is funny, and I'll catch more of it that way. Not as much lately, so I don't really know as many of the new people on Saturday Night Live. But this has been something they've talked about, is free speech. And there's an article from the Freedom Forum Institute, which I've talked about before. I think it's a really interesting website. You might want to check it out. But they talked about, funny or not, speech is still free. And there was a comedian on Saturday Night Live not too long ago, earlier this month, September, I think. Shane Gillis was hired and then promptly fired by the long-running sketch comedy show after his racist and homophobic comments from a year-old podcast came to light. So he didn't say it on the show. He said it on a podcast over a year ago. And I've seen this trend where, you know, sometimes things from 10 years ago, 20 years ago come up where somebody says something, and what is acceptable in the past obviously seems to be not as acceptable now. Now, racist and homophobic humor is always something I don't think is funny. But comedy sometimes uses these tropes to push forward a conversation about topics that are sensitive. And some of the most odd humor that I've ever seen, where you're like, oh, that wouldn't go today, actually comes from a place where there's like, this isn't right. You know, this isn't cool. And I think that it's one of the hardest things in the world is to be a comedian. I always think I'm sort of funny, but I'm not that kind of funny. And they're always experimenting and trying to push boundaries. And I think back to James Gunn from Guardians of the Galaxy, who I think is really an awesome guy. I'm just going to put this out there. And I know I have friends that were like, once he said something, they're never going to watch any of his movies again. Never. And I was Facebook friends with him before he was super famous. You know, he had done Slither, and I really liked the work he did on Dawn of the Dead remake. And he was part of the Troma universe. And I really thought he was a nice guy. He had a really cool life, and he would share things about his dog and his cat and his just all the things that he was going through. And he went through phases, you know, where he would direct like these movies where they're supposed to be a little bit shocking. There's this one guy, what was it called? Humanzi. It was like a chimpanzee and a human. It was terrible. That one really sucked. Sorry, James Gunn. But around that same time, he had made some really, I can't remember what he had said, but I think it was people thought it was pedophilia, and it really was just him trying to be a shocking joke. But if you followed the guy, you knew he seems like actually like one of the sweetest people. Like the things that he says normally, you're just like, I know he's trying to get attention for this really gross movie he's working on. So it just say like these crazy ass things that nobody would believe that he would actually mean. But people dig things up from 20 years ago, 15 years ago, 5 years ago, 10 years ago. It doesn't matter. It could be yesterday. And they take it out of context. And we still live in a country where freedom of speech is a real thing. And in the past, you could make a stupid joke, especially because before the internet, nobody really remember. Like, a lot of times they wouldn't be like, can you believe that so-and-so said this, and it's commemorated forever. But nowadays, everything is. So you have to always be careful. And I'm sure I'm going to say something stupid here, and down the road somebody will be like, yeah, she sucks. Whatever. But, and then, like, he was fired from his job doing Guardians of the Galaxy, and then it didn't matter, and then they brought him back. So what does that say? Does it say that we have a very short memory? Yes. Does it say that the court of public opinion is super powerful on social media? Yes. But it also shows that powerful people in Hollywood, they just wait it out long enough, and eventually people are going to forget, and they're going to like be able to do whatever they want. Which, in James Gunn's case, I think is fine, because I don't think he did anything really wrong. However, there are other actors who do terrible, terrible things, and I think getting away with it on that level is pretty disheartening. So, I get it. I get why people... they don't want to support people who say horrible things. And I think, you know, we're pretty delicate people now. We can't just let somebody say something and just go, well, that's what they think. Or, you know what? You don't like them? Don't buy their stuff. Why do you have to destroy someone's life? Why do you have to destroy their livelihood? And I see this happening with these celebrities, which you just don't go to their movies. Just don't support them. That's the best way to hurt anybody, really. But they have to go farther. They have to try to make somebody lose their job. And they do this with everyday people now, too. If you disagree with somebody, you go, oh, they said this. And you go, well, that's not really that bad. And they're like, they should be fired. I'm like, what? What about anything would make you want to ruin somebody's life? You don't know them that well. Why do you want to ruin anyone's life? So I feel like that we're coming to this world where we all like go, it's like a mob mentality, really, where we're all like trying to take down people who think differently than us. And that's not what our country is about. There needs to be some free speech. You need to have people out there who say things that you disagree with, because that's the world. There are always going to be people. And you got to learn how to react to things without like crying a river and being a soft-hearted, you know, crybaby, really. So what happened, right, Heather? What happened? You went off on your tangent. Shane Gillis, they were hired and then fired. Several comedians came to his defense, claiming that Gillis was a victim and his firing exemplified an erosion of free speech in the USA. But does it? So this latest comedy controversy highlights a tricky intersection between our fundamental freedoms and cultural trends. It also reveals the messy collisions that can take place between opposing viewpoints. And it illustrates commonly held misunderstandings about what it is and what is not considered free protected speech under the First Amendment. So being fired from Saturday Night Live or anything is not a First Amendment issue. The First Amendment only protects people in the U.S. from government censorship. Okay? Understand? But private companies are not bound by restrictions. So you know what? Like, they can fire you for anything in most states. You know, they have at will. They can just go, I don't like the way you look. You're kind of a jerk to people. We'll fire you. However, Gillis's firing from the Freedom Forum Institute, they say that it, the clashing opinions surrounding it does not mean that our right of free speech is in jeopardy. It's quite the opposite. So they say the founders included the First Amendment in the Constitution because they recognize the importance of free flow of ideas and information for a democratic government and of protecting the rights of people whose views might be unpopular. But if the government were to determine which speech is too offensive to be allowed, that could put them on a slippery slope. Bans on offensive speech might morph into bans of any speech that makes government leaders look bad or comes from political enemies. So the First Amendment and the breadth of its protections never changed for any of that reason. So, but public tastes have changed over the years, significantly. Popular comedic routines from decades past are considered objectionable by today's standards. Today, comedians who make women, minorities, LGBTQ individuals the butt of their jokes can expect that at least some of their audience will push back. So in August, popular comedian Dave Chappelle was publicly denounced for jokes he featured in his latest Netflix special that poked fun at the alleged victims of R. Kelly and Michael Jackson and mocked members of the LGBTQ community. Which, I'm going to say, I watched it. I thought most of his stuff was pretty funny. Some of it, with Chappelle, you always know he's pushing boundaries. So you come to expect it. Does it make it right or wrong? I guess that's up to you. So why is our standard for what's acceptable changed? So this evolution stems in large part from having more diverse voices invoked in the conversation, with historically marginalized communities taking advantage of increased opportunities to exercise their First Amendment rights and pushing back against speech that denigrates them. So the advent of internet and social media has provided these previously underrepresented groups with new open platforms to speak out, offer a new and different perspective, and generate broader support. But if the history of comedy in America is any indication, this undoubtedly won't be the last controversy, because comedy is always much more exciting if it's controversial. People love somebody being out there and saying stuff that they'd be afraid to say. So you know that's not the end of it. These debates push us to revisit our understanding of free speech and look for ways to navigate a complex culture full of differing viewpoints and experiences. But that can only happen if we look past the surface level attacks and assumptions. Free speech isn't always funny, nor is it always easy to understand, and will continue to breed conflict. But more speech for more people puts us in a trajectory towards a better society, they say. So whether you're a comedian that pushes boundaries or a comedian that merely pushes buttons, don't cry foul or free speech when people invoke their own right to free speech and start to push back vocally on your material. Joke is on you, because that's how the First Amendment works. So does that mean comedians who say things like that shouldn't? No. They can, but they may not make any money. So, and that sort of drives everything in our society. There's a whole question here that isn't addressed about art versus popular culture. And popular culture has often been thought of as being tasteless and watered down because the needs of the many make it so you can't do anything risky. Because if you don't like it, you know, they don't, oh, that makes me uncomfortable. I don't want to think about that. I don't want to have, like, something that makes me mad. And honestly, then you're missing out on the potential for something that makes you think of things in a brand new way. So I think they were within their rights, totally, Saturday Night Live, to fire this person. And if they hadn't, the outrage would have been so much that they would have lost something by that. But is it always right to do that? I don't think so. But, you know, they mentioned Dave Chappelle. I think he's brilliant. He says such funny things, and he comes up with things in a new way of thinking. And I've had comedians, God, what's his name? Jim, God, I can't remember his last name, Australian guy. And he sometimes pushes boundaries where, like, sometimes he's so funny. And he had I think it was his brother who was, or cousin who was quadriplegic, and he had this great comedy act where he talked about it. And some people were so upset because they thought it was making fun of him, and it really wasn't. It actually was loving and sweet, but it was a little gross because they talk about sex and hookers and whatever. And in the end, it was about his, I think, brother or friend being able to just be a normal person, to hang out with the guys and not really feel different. And there was a weird level of love to it. And I, you know, like some people will never agree with me on it, but you watch one of his acts like that and you think, well, that guy, he pushes boundaries, but it's really cool. And yet the same comedian had a few shows that I just almost wanted to, like, you know, I turned it off because I just thought it was so horrible. And he would talk about denigrating women, and it was to the point where it wasn't funny. And, you know, like, I have like this pretty open sense of humor where I think a lot of weird stuff is funny. And I love hearing people like who are talented at being funny go through stories. I love stories so much. And I want it to be stuff I've never heard. So I love that. I love it. But when you get something that's just mean-spirited, then I just turn off. It's just a horrible thing to like see somebody's dark side like that. So I get it. I get why people get so upset. But at the same time, I'm not the kind of person that's writing to, I don't know, HBO and going, you should never have that person on there again. Like trying to mess with their livelihood, because somebody out there might like it. It's just not me. So that's all I have to say about that one for now. But if you have thoughts about, you know, like comedy and what's appropriate, because, you know, I've talked to people about some things like Blazing Saddles would never really fly today. And yet I still think it's funny, and the commentary is just spot on for, you know, things about race and gender. And yet they're like, they're making fun of it. And they say the bad words. And they're like, yeah, they do. But it also, the purpose is to show how horrible people can be, but still have a sense of humor about it. And I think we're missing a lot of that today. So let's make a change about that. Okay, so that is the end of my intellectual freedom news, the main stuff. But today, I was starting to write about, changing history, rewriting history, because there's a lot of stuff that we feel bad about, we find out later, and we find out that things aren't beautiful and good about the thing that we thought and were told that is beautiful and good. An example will be like Columbus Day, which is coming right up. Or is it today? Oh my God, it's probably like this week sometime. But now they've changed it to Indigenous Peoples Day because people found out through history, they finally were taught the appropriate history, but you know, that could change too, that you know, there was violence and murder and rape and all this by Columbus. So nobody wants to have anything to do with Columbus anymore. But it is part of our world. And I, you know, like, hey, I'm a Viking lady. So, you know, that I kind of think Leif Erikson had more to do with it. But, you know, people can disagree. But is it right to rewrite history? Minnesota, there is a Fort Snelling, and they're talking about, there's a lot of people arguing about this. They want to change the name to include Native tribes, and to acknowledge that we pretty much murdered a bunch of Indians. And it's true. But do you change the name? Why do you change a name, first of all? Is it to, because you're like, we're acknowledging that bad things happen, but and by doing that, we change a name? Or are we actually just going, we don't want to think about the fact that horrible things happen here, so we're going to change the name to feel better, but also so we can forget that it happened? And a lot of that is starting to feel like we are changing history because we are uncomfortable from it. And on my Facebook today, I posted about, I'm going to bring it up because it was actually interesting that there was in 1985 in Pennsylvania, in Philadelphia, there was something that they don't talk about in history is that Pennsylvania State Police dropped a bomb on a black residential neighborhood, killing 6 adults and 5 children. And it was all because they were at war with a group called MOVE, a black revolutionary group that wanted to get away from government rule and to get back to a nature lifestyle. So they had an ongoing, I wouldn't say a battle, but a poor relationship with the city government and with the police in that city. And I think about, what was it, 77 or 78, there was an incident where the police, I think, were mostly bothering them. But according to what happened, one of the policemen died. And it seemed like it was kind of an accident, but maybe not, because they were being attacked. So this group, just to backtrack a little, their nature, they're kind of like black hippies back then. They're vegan, animal rights activists. They were protesting bad treatment by the police for black people in these neighborhoods. But the mayor and the people of in the Pennsylvania State Police decided that what looks to me like there was retribution on their mind, but was there? And what they did was they dropped a bomb, an actual bomb. It looked like sort of like it was something like dynamite, but they strapped C4 to it. And they dropped it on this house where all these people were because they thought they were a threat. And then they fired 10,000 rounds of ammunition at the house. And when they dropped the bomb, most of the people inside were pretty much killed. There was one survivor, a woman, who, if you ever see her talk, she, her one arm is totally burnt up. And when this fire started in the house and all the people pretty much were killed, the police department, the fire department actually, were told to let the building burn. They want to make sure everyone in there burned. But by doing so, they let it burn for so long that all these houses that were very close next to it burned down too. So they burned down about 61 houses in the neighborhood. So why is this something that hardly anybody knows about? And I've had people write to me and go, well, I remember it. But we don't talk about it. And to this day, the only person who's ever been punished for anything to do with this was one of the women, the only survivor who was escaped from the fire. And she served 7 years in prison. None of the police, none of the people in charge were punished in any way for dropping a bomb on a civilian neighborhood. So we have a problem in our society of selective memory and putting people forward in, you know, like idolizing people that are not always the best people. And over time, things that are acceptable, like in even back in 85, which isn't that long ago, burning black people in a neighborhood, I hate to say it, but sounded like it was much more acceptable. Today, at least there would be some more rage. With social media, you'd hope that people would be upset about it. So I guess part of what I'm thinking with this is that we can have outrage, but we don't erase the history. You know, because the Pennsylvania State Police screwed up and, you know, the police are supposed to be the good guys, we can't forgive that. We need to, like, talk about it. Does it mean that all police everywhere should not be trusted forever because of what one group did? No. But we should shine a light on misdeeds. And when they screw up, there should be a price to pay. So that I was thinking about today. But it led to me thinking about, I had taught a library class about what's going on in the library world and the future of libraries. And one of the chapters I talked about was the past of libraries. And even in the book that we had, because I was an adjunct, it was older and it talked about Melville Dewey, who creator of the Dewey Decimal System that most public libraries still use today. A lot of the students in the class had no idea that Dewey actually had some problems in his life. He was, he sexually harassed people. He was a racist. And recently they erased him. And I mean, he's still like, his system is still out there because it's too integrated into everything. He was no saint. And librarians didn't want to talk about his amoral behavior. He said that he was censured in 1906. So think about how long ago that was, when several women complained about his improper behavior towards him. This included unwanted kissing, hugging, and caressing in public. Even Dewey's daughter-in-law even moved out of his home because she was uncomfortable around him. He sexually harassed pretty much every woman that crossed his path. And he was sexist. So this was an addition, the ALA resolution to drop his name from an award that was given out. So this June, it used to be called the Melville Dewey Medal. So they dropped the name. So one of the other things that cited was his racism and anti-Semitism. He had a private club that he owned in Lake Placid. Dewey did not allow Jews or blacks to become visitors or members. So there's a pamphlet that read, "No one shall be received as a member or guest against whom there is a physical, moral, social, or race objection. It is even found impracticable to make exceptions to Jews or others excluded, even when unusual personal qualifications." So when news of the pamphlet became public, also in 1906, Dewey was forced to resign from his state library position. He defended himself, saying he had friends who were Jews, which sounds like a really crazy thing to say. But he also noted that a private club should be allowed to choose its members, which is true. You know, back then especially, that was sort of normal public policy. But we have a revisionist view of the world, and what everybody used to do is not going to fly now, which I'm glad it doesn't fly. But does that mean we should remove him from things? Should we not call the Dewey Decimal System the Dewey Decimal System? Should we not call a medal named after him? So this is the one that I think is more, it makes more sense why they do it, because he was jerk. He was a total jerk. But he wasn't being judged by 21st century standards back then. He was called out repeatedly for sexual harassment behavior during his time as there. But he's still considered a legend, and people say he's responsible for making it okay for women to be in a profession. So he liked women being around him, but he also liked women to be around him. You know what I mean? So, according to the Bureau of Labor Statistics, 79% of librarians are women. And yes, Dewey might be partly responsible for that, because he founded the Library School at Columbia in the late 1800s. He advocated for women to be admitted as students. So he wasn't a total bastard jerk, right? But he wasn't a feminist either. He had a speech titled "Librarianship as a Profession for College-Bred Women." Dewey had said, which I hate that title, Dewey said that although women had the character and intelligence to be librarians, if they had a college education, they were also more likely to get sick or leave the profession to pursue a home life, like quote unquote, to make babies. And women deserved smaller salaries than men, he said, because males, in addition to being capable of the same library work, could also lift a heavy case or climb a ladder. There are many uses for which a stout corduroy is really worth more than the finest silk. So yeah, he says, because we can't lift as heavy a stuff as men, that we're as worthy. And to be honest, I've worked with a lot of men in libraries, and I haven't seen her that anybody of any different size lift anything different than a man or a woman. So we don't work in a profession where lifting heavy crap is really going to come in handy. So in 1927, Dewey hired a stenographer who he described in simple spelling, which he championed because it eliminated extraneous letters, as a dainty little flapper, better looking than I expected. After he hugged and kissed her in public, she threatened to file charges and ended up settling with Dewey for $2,147.66 back in 1927, which is a lot of money. According to Wayne Wiegand, author of The Irrepressible Reformer, a biography of Melville Dewey, Dewey is upset with the settlement because he had not been reprimanded for anything improper, but because he worried the stenographer might spread rumors that she got $2,000 for no work. That's nuts. So, he was unrepentant, but he was censored by the ALA. Dewey still insisted he hadn't done anything wrong. Pure women would understand my ways, he said. So there's another person. The group unanimous vote surprised her. She expected a lot more drama, but there's none. People clapped and cheered. The change for ALA's decision in 2018 to remove the name of Lauren Goltz Wilder from Top Children's Author Award to Anti-Native American and Anti-Black Sentiment in her Little House on the Prairie series was changed to the Children's Literature Legacy Award. This bothers me far more than Melville Dewey, whose behavior is much more horrible. She's recalling a time when this, as a child, this was how people treated, you know, Native and minorities. And I feel like it's sort of that whole Tom Sawyer kind of thing where people get upset because certain words are used, because there's imagery that they don't like, and you shouldn't like it. But it's literature, and honestly, I grew up with all the Lauren Goltz Wilder books, and I think there's a lot of love in there. But I also think that it's the recollection of an older woman, and I think a lot of it was translated by her daughter, who might be throwing things in to spice it up. Is it real? Is it not? You can be offended by anything, and that is your right. But to take this very prestigious and loved series and to change the name of this award because they felt like the sentiment in the stories, that's a different thing. And I honestly disagree with that. And I think Dewey is far more deserving of this kind of horrible legacy that he's left behind, whereas I don't think Lauren Goltz Wilder really deserved it at all. So there's a lot about the harassment and racism and sexism. They said he was they dismissed it for a long time. I mean, a lot of this stuff happened in the 20s where he had to step down, but they said he was a naughty boy who was a product of his time. So what is the difference between him and Lauren Goltz Wilder? Racial insensitivity in a book from, like, you know, like our country's beginnings. And they say that there's outrage. A character refers to them as wild animals who do not deserve to live on the land they occupy. Little House on the Prairie makes reference to five black-faced men in raggedy-taggedy uniforms. And they talk about it. One of the characters says the only good Indian is a dead Indian. Okay. It is horrible. These things that they say is horrible. But can you not imagine that people said that these things happened? And why is it that we have to erase the past to make ourselves feel better? I think there are a lot of learning moments, and I say this time and time again, that if it makes you uncomfortable, good. Talk about it. Why does it make you uncomfortable? If somebody says, why would somebody do blackface? Yeah, why would they? Were they making fun of people? What do you think about that? Does that make you mad? Should they have ever done that? Boy, we've learned a lot, haven't we? People don't do that anymore. You know, say things. You know, why make it go away? Because you know what? You get rid of some of these things. Especially, I really am more angry about the Laura Ingalls Wilder. And, you know, they call it the Children's Literature Award. And I'm fine with that. But you take something that honored someone that was beloved in our society, stories that are still loved today, and you change it. Just like you change everything to make yourselves feel better. Is that the thing that really fixes the problem? And I don't believe it does. So anyway, they say that like Dewey's system has its own controversy. And I go back to that because they're Eurocentric, favorable to Christianity, which is true. One of the things that you like catalogers can do is their own censorship of other groups by putting them in like groupings that have no respect for the topic, that you hide things so no one can find these books, and you make it unfavorable. But they've changed a lot of things, especially like pagan religion stuff I've seen, where it goes from being really a horrible description to being a little more accurate over time. And it's something where we all educate ourselves and learn about it. They said Drabinsky finds Dewey's classification structure more offensive than any of his vices. It's all about white Christian power that's spread around the globe, she said. His personality pales in comparison to him as one individual dominating the structure of knowledge. So they own the rights. OCLC, Online Computer Library Center, owns the rights to the DDC, the Dewey Decimal System, DDC, classification. Yeah, and it said the system is continuously updated. Editors are now focusing on gender identity, sexual orientation, as well as providing new options for classifying works about indigenous peoples. So we're constantly changing history, and some things are for the better, and some things are not. There's a name change. The Melville Dewey Medal is still called it on the website, according to what was 2019. So it should be changing, but will it? And honestly, we're just a sensitive bunch of people. And I hope that we don't erase all the things that make us who we are today, that we can save a few things so we can have discussions and teach kids about, you know, what life was like. And boy, aren't we better? Haven't we grown? We've learned to be better people. But, you know, we weren't always that way. And why? So, on that note, I'm going to be getting ready to have birthday. And I hope you all have a great week. My best birthday present ever would be that you have a wonderful week. And that you start working on making your dreams come true. So, I'm going to be talking about writing over the next few weeks on and off. November will be hardcore, so I'll probably be talking about that. Hopefully it's exciting for you to get going on your own dreams. So please do your best, and I hope you have a great week. And I will talk to you next Monday. So have a wonderful, wonderful time. I'm going to just know that I think about this and I try to keep it interesting for myself and for you too. And I don't know, you know, I'm getting older, but I think better, maybe I'm a little more refined, maybe not, but we'll see. So I hope to talk to you again next week. See you next Monday. Have a great rest of the week. Bye, guys.